And we're doing this whole show live. We're just starting this new situation where I'm making Alejandro Rojas, who'll be coming right up, I'm making him stay late at work so we can do the whole show live. And I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show and supporting the show. And if you'd like to listen to the second hour of the show, it only takes a dollar a month or more. All that information is on podcastufo.com, right on the sidebar. And we have a live chat room going right now on podcastufo.com, right on the main page. It takes two clicks to get in there. You can ask our guest a question later on. And that guest is Peter Davenport from New Fork. He'll be on for both hour one and hour two. So get some questions ready for him. He was one of the first people on the Incident Exeter case back in, I think it was 1965, and that's local to me. And he also has done a bunch of different things. I think he had a sighting early on, too, back in the 50s in his youth. And great guy. I'm really looking forward to that. And that's enough for me. Alejandro, how are you?
I am good. How are you?
I am great in the great state of Maine. And we
Excellent.
Were just talking about traffic jams in Arizona. And there's hardly even roads here. So
really? Well, that's... Yeah. I don't know if that's good or bad. That's probably bad, huh? They get all clogged up, I'm assuming.
Well, it's good for the moose. But, yeah, it's...
We'll ride a moose. You got to be creative. Think outside of the box.
Well,
use a moose for transportation.
Tourism here is getting heavier and heavier every year. So when you get anything like, you know, July 4th weekend coming right up, boy, does I-95 goes right up the state of Maine, and it is clogged.
Really?
Yeah, from it goes way down into New Hampshire. Because there's tolls, you know, they have to go through tolls and stop at a toll, and that clogs everybody up. So it's always a pain. So I like being up in the mountain away from everybody and quiet.
Yeah. Well, I think that gives me an excuse to plug something. And since this is live, you can't stop me.
Where's the mute button? Okay.
Roswell. I'm going to be in Roswell this weekend. So that's exciting.
Right.
It's UFO related. It's going to be like my eighth year or something going out there. I did miss 1 year. But it's always a lot of fun, and they have the most amazing fireworks display. There's a fireworks company out there. So it's like 45 minutes, and you think the whole thing is the finale because they're just tons and tons. I think they just blew up all their extra ones out there. It's incredible. You would not imagine it in this little town in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico. But, of course, it'll be fun, and I will be seeing Tom and Don there and hearing what they have to say. Of course, they are in the limelight. They are quite notorious at this moment because of the Roswell Slides stuff.
Yeah, the lingering and lingering.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We'll see how long it lingers, but yeah, I promised I wouldn't talk about that. So what's going on with the news?
The news, it's too late. You already did talk about it, but I should mention, I not much about it, but today is Canadian Day, Canada Day, yay. So we do have a story up written by a Canadian, Chris Rutowski, and he runs a site up there where they do a lot of really good work on following sightings. And he wrote this story about the top 10 strangest Canadian UFO reports, and he based it off of UFO researchers and investigators that he pulled. So that's kind of fun. It's our Canadian Day story that's up there. And I kind of sprung that on you, so you probably don't have the link up yet. But
yeah, it's not there, you hoser.
Oh, I'm a hoser. I've been refraining from saying A and hoser, even though it's a lot of fun. And before the show started, we were doing quite a bit of it. It's I just started thinking, if it's Canada Day, shouldn't we be celebrating them and not making fun of them?
We're not. That is celebrating them.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
It'd be awesome to be able to talk like that.
You convinced me, A.
Yeah, hoser. All right.
So otherwise, though, speaking of other news in other countries, we've posted a story, and this was given to us by Andres Mueller. He has a 14 kind of website, Frontier Science, he calls that website, in Germany that's very popular. And he'll send us stories once in a while. And this is a really interesting one. So the Federal Administrative Supreme Court of Germany has forced the essentially the German government to release this UFO file. I guess they haven't done it yet, but there's a scientific organization that did a report on UFOs, and the German government has not wanted to release this, even though people know it exists. It was created by their scientific service, is what they call it. And I guess it has to do with Germany and the UN resolution to release UFO information. But it's been kind of a long-fought battle for UFO researchers to see this paper, and soon they will, because it had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court of Germany to release this document. So it's a really interesting file or a story. And that should be coming out soon. And as far as that UN resolution, it actually got watered down. It was a UN, I can't remember the exact word, but something like UN suggestion it came out to be. But if people aren't aware, in the 1970s, Sir Eric Gary of Grenada got really into UFOs. He said he had a sighting, and he went to the UN as a UN country delegate and said, we need to release information on UFOs and share information and create a department at the UN that investigates UFOs. It got stalled for a year. This was, I think, 76 to 77 and to 78. And finally, it came out as kind of this UN, I can't remember the word, but it is like a suggestion or something like that, which is just means that it got watered down to the point, but it did get voted on and passed on the records where all of the UN countries were to share their UFO information with the UN, and then they would all share it amongst each other in these countries. It never came out to fruition. We've had some interesting stories come out, and Lee Spiegel has written about this because Lee Spiegel actually organized. Yeah, he was involved. He organized a presentation at the UN for this thing. And we have found out later on that the UK government especially was really against the whole thing, and in the background was lobbying against it. So really interesting story, and I guess this German paper is about their implementation of this UN resolution. So it ought to be interesting to see, but pretty cool news there.
Did you get an idea of exactly when that will be released?
No, the story doesn't really go into when it may be released, just that just recently the ruling had come down.
I see. Okay.
However, Andreas Mueller did get other UFO files recently released, and we have a link to that story, and that's another story he had given us in the past as well. So, of course, we don't speak German, so we got to rely on some of the points that he made on those files. But there's some stuff that's somewhat interesting. It's kind of like the WikiLeaks UFO stuff that came out. It wasn't really exciting or groundbreaking, but it was interesting kind of stuff.
Nein sprechen Sie Deutsch. Yeah. Sorry.
That's German, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have latent talents that come out periodically, and you're just an impressive person.
Like blatant, I think, is more like it. Hey, before we go on to the next show, I just want to announce to our listeners that Art Bell is coming back on this network, and it's coming up, I think, I don't want to get this wrong, I think it's July 20th, and you can actually go to the Dark Matter Radio or Dark Matter Digital, Media Network. It has changed. The URL has changed, and you can find where you can support our Art for as little as like $5 a month for a subscription. Listen to all these shows. You know, these shows are 5 days a week. So I am just I'm getting a message, I think, from the producer of the show right here. So
DarkMatterDigitalNetwork.com.
There it is. Thank you, Keith.
Yeah.
Dark Matter Digital Network.
I just knew that.
That's where you want to go. And you can support Art. It's Midnight in the Desert. You can see the link right there. And I'm really excited about that. But we can go ahead and move on with the news if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm super excited, too. And what's funny is we wrote a story on that, and we included some of these fan trailers that are popping up on YouTube. And ever since then, I've gotten at least two or three other messages from people that have said, oh, you know, I created a fan trailer. Check it out. And at least one of them I posted on my Facebook, and the guy was really cool. He's like, oh, thank you. And it was a great trailer. But there's all these fan trailers for Art Bell's show coming up, popping up on YouTube, which is pretty cool. Everybody's really excited about it. I am as well.
Yeah, and I think he'll really like, you know, steering his own boat, being in charge of the digital,
yeah,
you know, in charge of the media he's on, or, you know, of course, with Keith's help, but he'll be in charge, and so there won't be any of the typical BS that's happened to him in the past. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
Very exciting. Speaking of exciting, it's the next exciting finding that I want to share with everybody, which has to do with Bob Lazar. So many of you probably know, of course, Bob Lazar is the alleged whistleblower who came out and said, I worked at Area 51, or specifically at this S4 facility near Area 51, but he kind of flew into Area 51 and was bused there, and he says he back-engineered alien technology. Well, he says that he also worked at Los Alamos, which is another secret kind of place where secret kind of projects are worked on, and he says he has degrees from Caltech and MIT. Well, none of this could be confirmed. There's no teachers that have come, or no students, you know, colleagues of his that said, oh, yeah, I went to school with him. Nor has there been anybody to come forward and say, yeah, I worked with him at Los Alamos. Now, George Knapp, who is an investigative journalist, he's won something like a numerous Emmy Awards. And this guy is a real deal. George Knapp, I'm a huge fan of his. If he says it, it's real. Integrity and journalistic integrity is a big deal to him. I believe what he has to say. And he says he has spoken with people that worked with Lazar at Los Alamos, but they don't want to come forward because they're afraid of getting in trouble. Well, Jeremy Corbell, who you've had on the show, who's done some documentaries, including on Bob Lazar, he debated, and he's had this online debate going on with Stanton Friedman. But he just recently released, just last week, and that when he was on Coast to Coast AM with George Knapp, that he found a physicist who worked at Los Alamos with Bob Lazar, and this guy has been willing to come forward. In fact, I wrote a story about it, and he shared with me this link that talks about this guy. He's Dr. Robert Krangle, and he is a physicist. You know, he's an impressive person. That's why this magazine had done this story on him and some of his work. But this guy has come forward and said, I worked with Bob Lazar. He says, I know Bob Lazar was a physicist with a security clearance at Los Alamos. One of the reasons he knows this is he was in security meetings with Bob Lazar. And these, I guess, are kind of routine meetings where people are told, now remember, you're working on secret projects, so don't tell anybody about it. Apparently, Bob Lazar was asleep at the meetings because he did go out and tell people about it. But he also says, you know, he just knew from being around there that Bob Lazar was a physicist. So it doesn't prove that Bob Lazar was working on alien technology. But what it does demonstrate is that he was a technician and arguably a scientist at Los Alamos. Well, at least it helps bolster that claim. And so the question is, why has Los Alamos been denying that Bob Lazar worked at Los Alamos if he actually did? So it's just more mystery. It could be proving that Bob Lazar isn't lying, at least in that, you know, Los Alamos is trying to erase his existence or working with them there, which is awfully mysterious. And George Knapp makes another point. A couple points that if we could prove he worked at Los Alamos, who cares about his college his degrees? Because Knapp has not been able to confirm that he has these degrees that he claims to have. And that if he was a technician at Los Alamos, which is an important place, then it's possible he did work at Area 51.
I got to tell you, I'm going to get some people mad at me and maybe even you a little bit, but I'm still totally on the fence about Bob Lazar. Now Matt's going to get really mad at me in the message board. But and here's the thing. You know, my brother-in-law was a chemist at Los Alamos for many years. And you know, there was you know, I had a conversation with him. He says, you know, there's 9,000 to 13,000 people working there at any given time, including about 600 to 800 subcontractors that are working there. There's hundreds and hundreds of buildings. And he said, you know, for him to remember someone that he met that was not close friends with back in the 1980s is basically, you know, I want to say almost impossible. Like, what would make Bob Lazar stand out? He said if he was famous, he was well known, or, you know, famous in his field or something like that, yes, of course you'd remember him. But if he was not a standout person, it would be really difficult to, you know, to remember him. And how did this come up? How did he all of a sudden say, oh, yeah, I knew Bob Lazar? And I know that some of it had to do with supposedly a friend had given him a tape. But one of the things my brother-in-law said was simply ask Bob Lazar what division and group he was in and just leave it at that. Don't give him any hints. Just ask him that question. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
How dare you not believe all of this? First, you don't believe in the Roswell slides. Now this. No, I agree with you. I'm a fence-sitter on this thing, too. Although I did totally disagree with that argument. I think that's kind of silly. I know people I worked with or I went to school with in 1980. I can easily remember. Of course, I'm not going to remember every kid at my school, but I'm going to remember a few people. So there's got to be people out there like Dr. Krangle who remember Bob Lazar if he really worked out there. So, I mean, that's completely possible. Not only that, this is an interesting part of the story, is Jeremy was using bots. I don't know where the hell he got these or how he uses them, but they're these bots that go out to your Facebook. They're looking at your Facebook. So he's like the NSA. But he's grabbing people talking about Bob Lazar, and he'll go look to see what they're doing. Anyway, they said, this person just said, my neighbor says he worked with Bob Lazar. So Jeremy got a hold of that guy, eventually became friends with the neighbor, and the neighbor said, yeah, I really did work with Bob Lazar. So, I mean, that's why this person never came forward before. That would make sense.
Okay.
So,
all right. I mean, I'm open to the fact that it's possible, but also it's, I want to say closer to improbable than possible, but, you know, if it's really, you know, factual, great. It's kind of a little bit of a mystery. That's all.
Yeah. It's funny. Right after I posted this story, within a minute, John Alexander pounced and he's sending me emails. This is ridiculous. I worked at Los Alamos. He wasn't there. So it's kind of funny. It's certainly
out of 9,000 or 10,000 people. How are you going to tell who's there and who's not? You know,
well,
even if you're
a physicist, if you worked with him, though, you would know. If you
know,
met
but I'm,
the guy.
Seeing, I'm for John Alexander to say, you know, he was not.
Oh,
there.
Oh, exactly. I know. For example, exactly. And you know, your point about subcontractors is exactly correct. In fact, Dr. Krangle told Jeremy that most of the employees out there are subcontractors now, and I think we hear this a lot. In fact, most of the people that the federal government hires these days are contractors. The percentage is super high. They've talked about this lately. But, yeah, you've got a number of great points there. I think, though, I give this guy the benefit of the doubt just because of his really impressive background. And there's no reason that this person should be putting his reputation on the line for making statements like this. So it's entirely possible.
Unless
working at Los Alamos is still a big leap from working on extraterrestrial spacecraft.
That's right.
So we're no closer to that.
And, you know, I mean, I listened to the interview and, you know, he did sound, you know, pretty cool and stuff like that. But, you know, there are people out there just looking for a little fun, a little fame.
True.
You know, so I don't know. I'm not 100% into it. But anyway, yeah. Poor Peter, I told him we'd be calling him 5 minutes ago. He's waiting by the phone. So we got to go, Alejandro. But it's been great. Thanks so much for doing this live.
All right.
And we will see you
later.
Next week.
All righty.
Thanks a lot, man.
Yep.
National UFO Reporting Center, good afternoon.
Well, hello, Peter. How are you? It's Martin from Podcast UFO. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Martin. Good to be here. Looking forward to this. Always enjoy talking about my favorite subject, UFOs.
Yes, I've always enjoyed your great enthusiasm when you're giving your UFO reports. It's always a lot of fun. And there's a lot of ground I want to cover. And, you know, we can talk about what's going on lately. But first of all, you know, I want to say, again, welcome to the show. And how did you get interested in this topic, Peter?
Yeah. I think I can honestly say I'm interested in it because in, I think it was July of 1954, I saw a UFO as a young boy with my entire family, with literally hundreds of other people who saw the same thing at a drive-in theater. And I've been captivated by the subject ever since. Clearly something is of immense magnitude and gravity is taking place on this planet, and most people don't know about it. Frankly, now that I am a scientist, much older and a scientist by training, I consider the field of ufology to be the most compelling and the most important scientific subject that has ever stood before man.
Wow.
So I'm afraid I'm hooked to it.
That is quite the statement, and, you know, I have to agree. It's funny, I have a son that's always been, you know, very skeptical of this, and he enjoys me talking about the show and, you know, guests and things going on. And he's starting to say things like, wouldn't it really be something if this is, you know, if this is really happening, you know, how exciting would it be? It would be so, you know, it would make the world a lot less boring, I think he said, something like that.
Boy, that's the truth.
Yeah.
If the UFO phenomenon is a real phenomenon, it adds an immense new dimension to our understanding of the galaxy and universe that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it does. I believe we are dealing with a real phenomenon. I wouldn't have spent the last 21 years of my life running the National UFO Reporting Center if I didn't feel that way, frankly.
Yep, yep. Now, when you had this sighting back in 1954, you said your family witnessed it as well. Were there other people involved?
Hundreds of people at a drive-in theater on the south side of the St. Louis airport. And I have written up a description, a detailed description of what happened, and posted it to our the National UFO Reporting Center website, ufocenter.com. And people can read my description of what happened, and it's not just a question of whether I might have been making something up, because whenever my family got together, my parents and my older brother and I got together, we would talk about it. What did we see? What did it look like? What did it do? And so on and so forth. And there must have been at least hundreds of people in that drive-in theater that night. It was in July of 1954, I believe, was the case. I remember that because I remember the automobile that we were sitting in, and we had that automobile in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
So July of 1954, Lambert Field, St. Louis Airport, was a dramatic sighting. An object as big as a full moon in the night sky, the color of a red traffic signal. And it was initially, when I first saw it, it was hovering motionless in the night sky. Suddenly, as I was looking at it, it suddenly accelerated and went right across the airport. It executed an S-shaped turn over the airport, disappeared over McDonnell Aircraft Corporation, and that was it. The whole sighting, I estimate, Martin, lasted, I would say, perhaps 10 seconds at the outside.
Wow.
It was a really quite a dramatic sighting.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, my father was in the air traffic control tower at the time on the other side of the airport, the north. Back in 1954, the tower was on the north side of the St. Louis airport. Now it's on the south side. But he was standing in that tower on the north side of the airport looking at the object with binoculars, as were the air traffic controllers on duty at the time.
Wow. Amazing. Did they notice on the radar as well?
Don't know. I was 6.5 years of age at the time, and if I had been 67 instead of 6, I would have been asking them those questions, but at 6.5, I didn't ask the questions that a good seasoned investigator should and would ask.
Yeah, of course. I just wondered if later on, if the subject came up, where your father might have mentioned that or not.
I don't recall at this time.
Now, were there other sightings that you was he an air traffic controller?
No, he was an executive for a major American airline, and we were at the airport that evening because he had to do some work at his office. And of course, back in the 50s, things were much different than they are today. He knew probably most of the people who worked at the airport. And so he happened to go up into the air traffic control tower to visit with his friends who were air traffic control operators. And they were just standing up there gabbing, I presume, when they saw that object on the south side of the airport.
Wow. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about tonight was you were involved in Incident Exeter. Working on that.
I
might
indeed.
Be jumping too far ahead because that was back in 65, right?
That's correct. Uh-huh. September 3rd it occurred. And I was involved in it through an act of serendipity. I worked for a newspaper in southern New Hampshire at the time. I lived in East Derry, New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah.
Most people who are familiar with the state know where Derry, New Hampshire is a popular mm-hmm. place for politicians to go and talk now. And I worked for the Derry News for about probably 9 or 10 months. And somehow, some way, the editor and I got on the subject of UFOs, and he was an absolute dyed-in-the-wool skeptic. Hmm. And in about the first week of September 1965, the year I graduated from high school in Derry, we had a very dramatic sighting in Exeter. It was covered by the Manchester Union Leader. And my editor read that article, and he came to me and he said, "Peter, you're now a Cub reporter. I want you to go up to Exeter, New Hampshire, and get a story for us about this sighting." So I made several trips up there. I talked to the two police officers, Hunt and Bertrand, who had seen the object while they were standing together. I talked to a hitchhiker, a young 18-year-old boy who had been chased by a disc out on a rural highway near Kensington, New Hampshire. Technically speaking, the sighting occurred in Kensington, not in Exeter,
oh,
but the
yeah.
Exeter police force was involved. So I wrote a two-part article that was published in mid-September 1965, and in the year 2000, actually wrote the piece on the incident at Exeter for Ronald D. Story, who edited the UFO Encyclopedia. Wrote the piece about the incident at Exeter. It was really very interesting, very dramatic, and that was my second experience with UFOs.
Wow. Can we, for the listener out there that's not familiar with that case, I think it's one of the big cases. Well, I think it's probably in the top 20 or 30, I would imagine, as time goes on. I don't know how you feel about that, but...
It was pretty dramatic, and a lot of people were involved. It really started not in the wee hours of the morning when the hitchhiker, his name was Norman Muscarello, as I recall, was chased by the object. The incident had started apparently about 4 hours earlier. Officer Bertrand was on patrol, and he came upon a what they call a roundabout, a traffic circle up there. And as I remember, there was a car that was parked in the center of the traffic circle, which was very unusual. Cars don't go there. It's grass. So he investigated, and he found a woman who was hunkered down on the floor of the back seat, and her dog, as I remember, was hunkered down on the floor in the front seat. And she was telling, when he approached the car, she started explaining to the officer that she had been chased by a disc from a nearby town, and in desperation trying to get away from it, she pulled up on the traffic island. Well, he didn't know what to make of that, but she was taken to the hospital, as I recall. And later that night, about 2 or 2:30 in the morning, he heard a call to all units from their headquarters in Exeter to the effect that a young man had just burst into the Exeter Police Force office, and he was quite excited, quite muddied. Obviously, he'd been in a swamp or a thicket or something like that, which was had indeed been the case, talking about how he had been hitchhiking on a rural road near Kensington, and he had been approached by a saucer that scared him so badly he started running. In final desperation, he jumped into a swamp, which was on one side of the road, and hunkered down over or under some bushes. The object that had chased him pulled right above him, and it rotated 90 degrees, so it's now pointed, the edge of the disc is pointed down at him, and he said it hit its high beams. He said he's never seen light as bright as that. So I interviewed all of these people who were involved, and I was left convinced that they had experienced something quite real and, to them at the time, quite frightening.
Right. What did you ever think of the supposed debunking of a airplane refueler? Did you ever hear that one?
Oh, I've heard a lot of attempts to debunk it or claim it wasn't true, but I talked to the witnesses literally days after they had had their experience, and one of the police officers, Officer Bertrand, had been in the U.S. Air Force, and the notion that he would mistake a refueling aircraft for a UFO is just utter nonsense. So these claims always come forward, are always presented after a major event like that has occurred. I suspect there's a concerted effort on the part of, I suspect, the government to discredit the case, and if they can't discredit the case, they'll try to discredit the people.
Right,
people
right.
who are involved in it.
Peter, we're having just a little bit of sound issue. I'm wondering if you could make sure that you're right up to your phone.
You bet.
Okay.
Is that a little better?
That is better, yes.
Okay, yeah.
Let's talk about New Fork. Is that the first? This is you actually man basically most of the work on that, don't you?
Yep, I'm the only person here. And
I wanted to say that, but it was I can't believe you can do it.
It's a pretty major effort for sure. And some days I wonder how I've done it, and most days I wonder why I've done it. But I think the principal driving force is what I mentioned earlier. It's the greatest scientific question before mankind. Are we alone in this universe, or are we not? And clearly, the answer to that question from my seat here at the National UFO Reporting Center is we are not alone, and there is some fundamental relationship between these creatures that we presume navigate in these ships that are being reported to us that we are not yet aware of. And if we can prove that they are there, and maybe we can talk about my proposal for doing that later in the program.
Sure.
Using passive radar, if we can prove they're there, it's the greatest scientific discovery of all time.
Yeah, many times I brought up on this show that this is such a passing phenomena that cannot be repeated. It's there, like you mentioned early on that sighting where there was a 10-second involvement in what mm-hmm. you saw. And a lot of times, that's all you have. The other day, yesterday, I was in Boston, and something caught my eye and in the sky, and I went to get my phone, and by the time I got my phone ready to take a picture, it was already gone. But by the way, it's kind of funny, it ended up being a blimp, and it was like mm-hmm. going through the trees. So, but it really, something caught my eye, and it looked different. But a lot of times you just don't have time to react.
Yep.
You know, you're fumbling, and you're like trying to find, now we all walk around with cameras now, basically, on our phones, or a lot of people do. But it's still when I had a sighting back in 2006 and by the way, I'm going to talk a little bit about this. I had no idea that it could be reported. I didn't even know that was an option. But when I had my sighting, the last thing I would have thought of is grabbing a camera.
Mm-hmm.
I was just so mesmerized and like, what the heck?
Often happens. People are so focused on this strange object that they're looking at before them that they don't even stop to think to get a photographic record of it.
Right, right. And so about reporting UFOs, like I just mentioned, the only thing I could think of was to call the police department, which I did. I got the runaround. It was not a fun experience, but I had no idea who to call. But even mm-hmm. with that going on, I'm saying maybe I don't know if I'm what you consider an average person out there, but I was a person that had not seen anything before that happened. I didn't know what to do, and I think that has got to be a major percentage of people that have sightings. They must mm-hmm. come up with the same thing. I don't know where to go with this. Some of them think to go online and take a look, but I didn't.
Yeah. Most 911 facilities across the country know about our center. So if a person dials 911 on his telephone and goes to the local emergency response center, most of them, perhaps all of them by now, have our contact information, both
really?
Website as well as hotline telephone number. They should have given that to you. I guess there may still be a few Luddites out there that don't have it, some hangers-on, but most people, if they call the local 911 facility, will be given our number.
Isn't that amazing? That's great.
Yeah.
I really think that's great. And one of the things I was thinking about, all these reports come in. Would you have a guess of how many per year that you handle?
Yes, I am posting probably about between 6,000 and 10,000 reports per year, although we get vastly more than that. Most people do not want to submit a written report. It's one of the hardest things in this job is trying to get people to write down what they've seen. Most people just want to talk about it. They want to call. They'll chit-chat for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. Most people want 30 or 40 or 50 minutes to tell me the whole story, and I try to stop them from doing that. What I want people to do, if they believe they've been witness to a UFO, is write out a detailed description of what it was they saw and submit it using our online report form. So
mm-hmm.
we get many more calls than we get reports. And what people see on our website probably represents a third of what we receive. So, for example, in the month of June, we posted between 500 and 600 reports to our website, and that might represent, the 1,000 or 1,500 contacts we had, and most of those people don't follow up with a report. It's a great tragedy. And here's an interesting factoid, Martin, that you might find very interesting. It is my estimate now, after having done this job for 21 years, it is my estimate that out of 20,000 or so Americans who witness what they think may have been a UFO. Only one out of 20,000 will ever report it.
One out of 20,000?
Mm-hmm. Isn't that odd?
Oh, my God. I had no idea. I have been in rooms like in conferences where the speaker, for instance, Richard Dolan once said, how many people think they have seen a UFO and watched the hands, and then how many people reported it? And, you know, it's just a few hands go up. Now, and here's the thing about that. If these people are at a convention about UFOs, they're more likely to be the type of person that would have reported it than not. So then you factor all that in. And so if you do the math, you come up with an enormous amount of possible sightings per year. I mean,
absolutely
unfathomable.
Yes, I agree. And it's very frustrating to us who know that most of the reports are falling through the cracks. It's very frustrating that we're not receiving those reports. And I have never heard so many excuses in all my life as I've heard running a UFO hotline as to why people cannot write it down, cannot write down the details of their sighting. It's sort of disheartening, actually. But fortunately, there are some many diligent people out there, enough so we're getting a fairly steady stream of high-quality reports from those relatively few people who are willing to write it down and report it.
If you had to guess why a person wouldn't go through with a report once they contacted you, why would you think that might be the possibility?
Yeah, I don't think we have enough time remaining in this program for me to cite all of the excuses that people have leveled at me. It's just amazing. So a lot of people say, well, they're in a sensitive business. And,
I was wondering about that.
They would pull their top secret security clearance and they'd lose their job at the solid landfill, something like that. And on and on. They don't want their family to know. They don't want this person to know. It's just amazing the excuses that people will come up with that will get them off the hook of writing just one or two or three paragraphs to describe what they saw.
Well, in a way, I understand, you know, the ridicule factor is all part of that. Because, you know, just to, for instance, going on further about the sighting I had, I told one person that I worked with the following Monday or whatever it was. And I said, now don't tell anybody. And, you know, it wasn't too long. You know, maybe a couple of days later, there was a lot of teasing going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Well, that's the advantage of having a national UFO reporting center. And we do essentially the same thing that MUFON does. They do a good job at collecting reports as well. But that's where the guaranteed anonymity comes into play, because if a person reports to our center and we post the report, nobody will ever know who had submitted the report. So they don't have to worry about ridicule. Nobody will know who they are who have submitted the report to our center.
You know, we have a message up on the message board that kind of dovetails this, and that is Matt wanted to know why that witness information wasn't up there. And I realize that it is, you know, with anonymity, you can get truthful information and a lot of information out there. However, is there ever a point where someone wants to be contacted by someone who investigates a particular case or something like that?
You bet. But most cases, in my opinion, usually do not warrant the amount of resource you have to dedicate to an investigation. An object, a distant object in the daytime or nighttime sky, probably does very little good for an investigator to go out and interview the witness. If it's just a distant object, we'll probably never know what it is or what it was. What I encourage people to do, and they can be their own investigators, and people, we live in a society in which everybody expects somebody else to do the work. That's why committees are so popular. But, in fact, the witness can do a great deal by contacting the press, radio, television, and newspapers to apprise them of that person's sighting and to ask them if the person can get some publicity or if the news media would publicize it and encourage anybody else who might have seen the same thing to come forward. But for some strange reason, people hesitate to do that, even though the press is often willing to impart anonymity to a witness. I don't understand it. In fact, the young people are sort of interesting. It's a bit distressing when I encourage them to contact the press. More often than not, in dealing with a person who's maybe 25 or younger, they'll say, "Who is that?" They don't know who the press is or are. And I say, "Well, radio, television, and newspapers." And they say, "Well, do you have any telephone numbers for them?" And I say, "No." They're in your area. Look them up in the telephone book and apprise them of your sighting and see if you can get some publicity. And almost invariably, they do not do that. It's very strange.
You know, one thing, I work with almost 30 young people in a startup. I do, a lot of them are 25 or under, most of them. And every single person there knows that I do this show. And not one person gives me a hard time about it. And that some of them listen to it. Some may be listening right now. So I think it's a good thing that young people are, you know, interested in this subject, because and this is going to segue into my next question. You know, we need this to carry on. It's very important, I believe, the same way you do. But speaking of carrying on, with all the work you do, and you're really totally, totally dedicated, do you have a predecessor, someone that will pick up when you're ready to slow
yes.
down a little bit?
Yeah, that's pretty well provided for. That eliminates the possibility of somebody being able to eliminate the hotline by eliminating me.
Wow.
We've made a provision for that, and the person is aware of it and is willing to take it over in the event that I'm not able to do it. And that's a good point. I have an immense amount of material, most of all a database that now has about 108,000 entries in it, and that work should be continued. It's far more important than the welfare of one single individual. And
do you think this person or people would have the same dedication that you have?
Well, once they started taking calls and receiving reports, I think they would. It's an addictive pastime. If you're interested in UFOs in the first place, to have free reign of the hotline is an immense luxury, because you see what's going on not just across the United States but around the world with respect to the UFO phenomenon.
Now, one of the things, you know, MUFON is another place where people call in and, you know, give reports. There's investigations and all that. Has there ever been any talk about some type of unity between different organizations, even internationally, that you're aware of?
Oh, yes. Everybody wants all these UFO organizations to unify, and one person wants control of it. And to date, I've avoided that. MUFON has actually proposed that to me so that our databases are merged, but I've decided that I really don't want to do that. I don't want to have worked for 21 years only to give all my information away for free. So I think a little competition is probably a good thing, because if there were one body that controlled all of the flow of information, and that entity decided to make a decision that the contributors were not pleased with, it would be sort of the Greek syndrome, alluding to the situation in Greece this week. many of them would want to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a little competition is a good idea, and there are enough UFO sightings and sighting reports to keep all UFO organizations plenty busy. If we're catching, if my estimate is right, that only one out of 20,000 UFO reports is ever reported by the witness, then there's plenty of work to be done still, and enough for many UFO organizations is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Up on the message board, we had a question. Someone wanted to know basically what your thoughts were of the government if, it remains to be seen whether the government's covering up. I think there's, in my opinion, it's a possibility that there's some fragment of the government, at least, that has covered up in the past, possibly still, or most likely still, I would say, because, you know, there's still reports coming into the Air Force and that are just hush-hushed. But what do you think it would take? This is the question on the message board. What do you think it would take for the government to finally admit that these things are happening?
Well, I think it's going to take an overt display, something like the Phoenix Lights back in 1997, March of 97, so that the government's position is just made extraneous. They've been lying to the American people about UFOs, I believe, since the 1940s. After you've been lying for that length of time on a subject of that gravity, of that importance, then it's very difficult to do an about-face and say, well, we've been lying to you for 67 years, but now we're going to come clean and tell you what's really going on. So they've painted themselves into a corner, and they're probably trying to figure out what they're going to do if there's a really dramatic, overt display of UFO presence in the near-Earth environment. And in fact, we're getting a lot of reports that, in my opinion, fall under that category. A lot of reports. And the most interesting phenomenon currently, in my opinion, is the reports of displays of clusters of red, orange, yellow, amber, and gold orbs or fireballs, call them what you will. We really don't have an adequate term because we don't know what these things are, and we probably will not know until we have a long-handled butterfly net that allows us to reach up and snag one of these things and bring it down to the laboratory bench. But the U.S. government is a strange bird. In fact, my greatest concern is not the UFOs. My greatest concern is the possibility that our governments are now coordinating their activities with alien creatures. And when I look at what the U.S. government is now doing to the American people instead of for the American people, which is what they should be doing, in my opinion, I get very concerned. And some of the examples are the U.S. government seems dedicated to taking firearms away from the American people. That's not their job, of course. Under Article 6, Paragraph 2 of the Constitution, any public servant who takes an oath of office swears and testifies to the effect that he or she is going to defend and protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And suddenly, as soon as they take office, they're trying to re-engineer the country and re-engineer individual citizens' lives. So when I see this take place and I ask myself, why are they doing that? And I bounce it off the UFO phenomenon, it makes me wonder what's going on in Washington, D.C. Clearly, those people know about UFOs. If I can, with nothing more than a telephone, a computer, a tape recorder, and a dedicated webmaster can collect 108,000 UFO reports and post them, I can just imagine how many the U.S. government must have in its files. Must be in the millions.
You know, that's right. That is, while you're mentioning this, I mentioned earlier that I didn't know who to call when I had my sighting. The Air Force was one of the things on my mind. Like, should I call the Air Force? And yeah. I imagine that a lot of people do. A question up on the message board. And by the way, if you're listening live, you can jump in to the message board. It's right on Podcast UFO. And we're taking calls in the second hour of the show. And, you know, this darn chat room just goes away on me. Here we go. What is your point of view on the most effective way for disclosure to take place, other than you're saying a massive sighting?
Yeah, well, I've been over that ground before. It's a very good question. It's very pertinent. And my response is very simple. Please read the paper that is posted to the homepage of the National UFO Reporting Center, the paper in which I describe the use of passive radar for detecting the presence of UFOs in the near-Earth environment. The paper was written in preparation for a presentation at the MUFON Symposium in Denver in July of 2004. And the day MUFON published the abstract, the one-paragraph abstract of my paper, I got a telephone call from a senior officer at the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C. He called from his office. It was during daylight hour, during work hours. And he said, "Mr. Davenport, I am so-and-so." He said, "I am a senior officer at the Central Intelligence Agency. I've been with them for over two decades." He said, "To let you know how senior I am the person who gives President Bush his daily briefing every morning at 6:30 a.m. He said, "A retired colleague of mine just sent me a copy of the abstract of your paper. He said, if you build the radar system that you describe in your paper, he said, you will be successful in answering the question of whether UFOs are real or not." He didn't say, he chose his words very carefully, of course. He didn't say you will detect UFOs, because that probably would have had him violating a secrecy oath. He just said, "You will be successful in answering the question of whether UFOs are real or not." Well, we've had several conversations and exchanged emails since that first conversation. That first conversation occurred on the 6th of July, 2004. And this guy is very interested in UFOs, and he described to me, he's a PhD, he has a PhD in physics, he described to me the fact that during the first decade or two of his work at the CIA, his principal responsibility was building passive radar systems for the clandestine detection of targets. So that tells me several things. One, that my proposal for breaking down the barriers to UFO secrecy has merit to it. It also tells me that the U.S. government knows fully well what's going on, and they probably are operating passive radar systems all the time and see UFOs, I suspect, on a daily basis.
Hmm. Wow. Amazing. So that is on that's on the New Fork website?
Yes, it's been there for 11 years. And I rarely get a comment. But I solved the problem. We can build a passive radar system. And many people probably are not familiar with passive radar, but if they go to our homepage, last Wednesday, we updated the homepage, and I put some links and some articles about passive radar on our homepage, and people can read about it, and they will see that human beings, we mere citizens and civilians, are now, because of the developments in computers and the global positioning system, we are now able to detect UFOs and track them by ourselves. We don't need to rely on the government anymore to do that for us.
Wow.
I think that's pretty exciting. And what I've been touting this system for over 20 years. I've been to four billionaires. I've explained it to one, and I've sent letters to the others. And we could build this system out of pocket change in their coffee fund. And yet I have yet to receive any funding for my proposal.
Yes.
It's very strange.
Yeah. Yep. There's a few other people out there with some ideas. We can talk about that a little bit in the second hour. We're going to take a quick music break. Okay, we're in hour two, and we're live with Peter Davenport. And in this hour, again, we can take phone calls as well as you can jump in the message board, on the message board at podcastufo.com. And once again, that phone number is 603-967-4030. You still there, Peter?
I am still with you, and I gather from your area code that you must be located in New Hampshire.
That's I am north of New Hampshire, and for some reason Skype gave me that number. I wasn't even living in New Hampshire at the time. I'm in Maine, the great state of Maine.
Oh, yes.
Up on top of a mountain where there's beautiful views, no UFOs yet, and lots of mosquitoes.
And black flies.
The black flies. Now, you're located in, is it Washington?
Washington State. I'm in eastern Washington. The National UFO Reporting Center and its hotline used to be in Seattle until 9 years ago, and then I moved to a more rural part of the state, so I'm about 50 miles west of Spokane now.
You know, I took a trip up through there a few years ago, and it's absolutely beautiful nature.
It is gorgeous. Mm-hmm.
I absolutely loved it. I went up to see Mount St. Helens. No.
Mount St. Helens,
Yeah, Mount St. Helens. And that whole area.
The volcano.
But just drove right up, all the way up through into Canada, and it was absolutely gorgeous. Really had a wonderful time. One of my favorite areas of the country.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful place to live. If I didn't live here, I would live in Vermont, New Hampshire, or Maine. Yeah. I love those places.
They're wonderful, except for the winter, but that's another podcast.
I'm going to be back there in September for my 50th high school reunion in Derry.
Oh, really? Wow. How about that?
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. How about that? Okay. You were talking, you're just blocking your phone calls, I think you just said, in between our show break. And how many calls would you guess that you get per day?
Oh, a typical day is we get somewhere between 10 and 50 calls per day. It's highly variable. Mm-hmm. And probably two-thirds of those are UFO-related. The others are from radio talk show hosts or news people who are seeking information or personal calls. So I would say on average I get about 20 to 25 reports every day over the telephone. But as I mentioned earlier, I suspect it's not over a quarter or a third of those people who call and want to tell me all about their sighting, not over a quarter or a third of those people who call follow up with a written report. So we lose all that information. I guess writing a paragraph or two has become too difficult for most Americans.
Now, do you sometimes almost feel like writing it yourself after you have the discussion with them? You just won't do it. They have to do it themselves.
I don't want to do it. If that's too much for them, I probably don't want their report anyway.
Yeah, yeah, I see.
You have to be dedicated, outspoken, aggressive, determined, resolute, and if they are not that, I allow for the possibility that their call may have been a prank call.
And I'm sure that happens.
Oh, 60%. Some days, I estimate 60% of the calls are prank calls from young, rude, oftentimes foul-mouthed, Americans, generally males, but not always.
Oh, that's sad. I'm glad that you you keep persisting at doing this even through all that.
Well, it's not very pleasant. I I don't know what's wrong with young Americans. They're different from the way they were when I was that age. And it's very strange and tragic. They apparently don't have enough work or enough responsibility in their lives to keep them busy. So their form of recreation is to call somebody and scream quadruple X-rated profanity at them.
Oh, boy.
Very strange.
Yeah. Now, for people, do people actually send email to you as well, report that way?
They do, but it's a wasted effort. What we ask people to do, if they've seen a UFO, they're welcome to call the hotline if it's been within the last week or so, but the telephone call is almost an extraneous part of the process because it doesn't serve to capture the information. I often equate it to sitting at a red light in your powerful pickup truck and racing the engine. It makes you feel good, it sounds good, it draws attention, but it doesn't do anything. The only kind of report that we can use is a detailed, carefully prepared, objective, factual, grammatically correct statement that describes the sighting or the incident that the person is reporting in sufficient detail so that another person reading the report can understand clearly what it all looked like to the original witness. That's what we ask people to do, and some days you'd think we're asking for their firstborn, but there are a lot of people who nevertheless do follow through and submit those reports, and those are the ones that you see on our website at ufocenter.com.
Now, do you ever send information out to investigators?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, usually we send it out to MUFON witness or MUFON investigators, field investigators. I prefer to deal with them because they're a known quantity. They're under supervision of the state director, who usually is a pretty professional person. And most of all, we know that if we hand a case off to a MUFON investigator, the witness's anonymity is going to be preserved. That's one of their characteristics, one of their guarantees, is just as the National UFO Reporting Center guarantees anonymity, so does MUFON. So we know that the witness is going to be protected. So we just had a case like this. It's posted to our website, a case in West Plains, I think it's West Plains or High Plains, Oregon. There's a photo on our homepage, and Tom Bowden, who's the state director for MUFON, contacted me shortly after we posted that report and requested contact information, which I gave him, and they're in the process of investigating that case now. Although, again, a point I've made earlier in this program is, once an object has been seen and is gone, unless it was on the ground and left marks, broken branches, compression marks in the ground, and so on and so forth, it's my opinion that there's not much that can be done, particularly if you wait more than 4 or 5 days after the event. Mm. If you place publicity in the news media immediately after the event, you might be successful in causing other people who've seen the same thing to come forward. But after 4 or 5 days, my opinion is that most people, even if they had a dramatic sighting, will have forgotten about it or will be unwilling. If they haven't already come forward, they'd probably be unwilling to come forward in response to a request from investigators. Mm. But, yeah, we deal with MUFON investigators on a fairly routine basis.
That's good. Now, when did the hotline itself start? At the same time that you began with the website, you said it was 21 years ago?
Well, that's when I took it over from the founder and my predecessor, Mr. Robert Gribble.
Oh.
He was a retired Seattle fireman who set up the hotline in October of 1974. So we're coming up on our 41st birthday here very soon. And he turned it over to me in, I think it was August of 1994. He'd done it for 20 years, and I think he was pretty well worn out. And after I've done it for 21, I understand why he would have been worn out, because it takes a great deal of energy and a great deal of devotion and dedication to keep the thing running, and a great deal of expense.
Mm-hmm.
It's run out of my pocket, largely.
Really?
So, but that's when it started, was in October of 1974. And ironically, that's just about the time I moved to Seattle. It has often made me wonder whether there was something behind my moving to Seattle that I'm not aware of. But I took it over in August of 1994, and I've been doing it ever since.
A question up on the message board. How confident were you that the person was actually talking with Bush's CIA briefing guy? I'm sorry, that sounds a little convoluted. I may have heard that
I think
wrong.
The person is probably alluding to the guy who called.
Hang on just a second, Peter. We have a call come in.
Mm-hmm.
Caller, thanks for calling. Please identify yourself and give a question.
Hey, Martin, this is Lee McDonald. I'm calling to ask Peter a question regarding, he said earlier on that he had been in contact with CIA gentlemen. And I just want to know how he vetted the gentleman. I guess he said he was Bush's, the guy who gave Bush the daily briefings at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
So I just want to know how he vetted that gentleman.
How I what?
How you vetted him. Made
well,
sure that it was...
This, it turns out that this individual who worked for the CIA is very, very well known in the CIA community. And he has lines of communication with a lot of people in the CIA, in the UFO community. I've talked with him a number of times. I've exchanged email with him. He's quite well known. And I've told this story to enough people who know him well. I know people who have worked for him. And they assure me that he has a very real and very keen interest in the CIA or in the UFO phenomenon. So there's virtually no doubt in my mind that he was who he said he was.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, that's excellent. I just wanted to make sure that point was really understood by the folks in the chat room.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And please bear in mind, I used to work in military intelligence, too. I used to be a Russian translator for the Army Security Agency. So I am sensitive to the type of issue that the caller just raised and would not allow myself, if I could help it, to be deceived that easily. I require evidence. In fact, most of our listeners would be quite surprised to learn just how skeptical I am when somebody calls me over the hotline or sends me an email or emails a formal report, just how skeptical I am about most reports. People have to convince me with their evidence, most of all with their behavior, too. You can tell a great deal about a person just from that person's voice over the telephone. Is this a serious person or is this not a serious person? And they have to convince me that they're a serious person, they're calling about a serious sighting, and so on and so forth. So the caller raises a good point.
Well, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks Martin. Just one last comment. I've always believed that within the UFO community, we ourselves must be better stewards with our information. And, of course, that's proved out with various hoaxes that have been perpetrated on the UFO community by not doing so.
Yep.
Nevertheless, thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate the answers.
Thank you the call. And the caller raises another good question, and that is how many people there may be who call themselves ufologists whose ultimate objective is really to deceive people and to get people off the scent of very good cases. This, I saw this in the Phoenix Lights case, and I've seen it several times with regard to the sightings of these fireballs that I alluded to earlier in the program. People sending me a message saying, well, you can cancel that report because I found the people who launched the Chinese lanterns. And
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, it's very tempting to delete a case or to qualify a case so people will know that it was Chinese lanterns. But I'm in the habit of going back to that witness or the person who supplied that information and asking for the actual street address where the launch was initiated or who did it or how many were launched. And usually those people just go away. They don't want to provide those details, and in many cases, I assume, they don't want to provide the details because they don't have the details. Their initial report was a prank to try to get me off the scent. So you have to be very careful in this field.
Absolutely. And speaking of Chinese lanterns, how much of a pain in the butt has that been?
Really, not very much. When we get a report, there's several things that can be done while we're on the telephone with the witness. Most of all is to find out how large the objects appear to be from the witness's vantage point. The other thing that we encourage people to do before they submit their written report using our online report form is call the National Weather Service or the FAA Flight Service Station for that area and request data for the velocity and direction of winds aloft at 3, 6, and 9,000 feet, and encourage the caller, the witness, to include that data with his report. Because what that data can do, it can resolve the question of whether the objects were drifting with the wind or whether they were going some direction opposite the wind. If the latter is the case, then they must have been self-propelled, because obviously Chinese lanterns or any kind of hot air balloon is going to drift with the prevailing wind. They're not self-propelled.
Right.
So that's one thing that I encourage anybody who sees one of these displays to do. In fact, if people would like to know, if they'd like to read some of the more dramatic cases on our website, we've posted a lot of them on our homepage, so people can simply click on the links that we've provided on our homepage, and it will take them to those reports. But if they want to see some interesting ones, the 1st and 2nd of June 2012, there was a very good one in St. Louis about two dozen orange lights seen by a St. Louis police officer. The next day, about at least a dozen orange lights seen just east of Vancouver, Washington, by a group of campers. They probably had 50 or 100 campers who were watching this display of orange lights, and the lights suddenly changed direction and streaked off to the north. Another interesting case was submitted by a former U.S. astronaut the 5th of July, 2013, so just about 2 years ago. He had a dramatic sighting in Athens, Texas. 10 weeks after that, a retired Arizona Highway Patrol officer in Glendale, Arizona, saw an estimated 150 to 200 of these objects streak across the sky in clusters. So there's an abundance of reports that people can read for this phenomenon, should they be interested.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about what you thought was the growing craft sighting. But before that, we've had this question come up a number of times on the message board, and that is, in your own opinion, what would you consider is the most compelling sighting that has been reported to NUFOR?
Well, two of them come to mind immediately, and one I've alluded to already, and that is the Phoenix Lights case. It was Thursday night, the 13th of March, 1997, so almost 18 years ago. I remember the night that it occurred very, vividly, clearly. And what a lot of people may not recognize, a lot of our readers may not recognize, is it is my suspicion that President William Jefferson Clinton, who was down in Florida on a golf trip down there on the night of the Phoenix Lights, may have injured his knee as a result of that UFO sighting. Very, very dramatic. It lasted about 2 hours, and objects were intercepted over the intersection of Indian School Road and 7th Avenue, and the two pilots that intercepted one of the objects may have chaperoned the president down to Florida from Washington, D.C. that day. They were tasked. We have reason to believe that they were part of the Air Force One and Air Force Two Protection Group, which is a very, very exclusive group of pilots who defend the president or vice president or any dignitary when they're flying, being flown in Air Force One or any other aircraft for that matter. So it's very interesting. Most people who have not heard me lecture on this point may not be aware that on the 15th of March, 1997, Saturday, President Clinton was on the front page of the New York Times lying in a hospital bed, and his alleged injury was either a ruse to allow his handlers to get him to a military safe area in response to the events over Phoenix that night, or perhaps he was being rushed to a waiting vehicle in a house where he'd never been before, and he may have been injured as he was being taken down a staircase or something like that. But my suspicion is President Clinton was injured when he was being moved in response to the declaration of a DEFCON 3 status, Defense Condition 3.
Has anyone ever been able to confirm that there was the DEFCON 3?
Bill Hamilton claims he has done that, and he wrote a book about the Phoenix Lights case. I have a copy of it. I don't know that he's confirmed it. I actually once called the office, the U.S. Air Force in the Pentagon, U.S. Air Force office, and requested that information, and I could hear the laughter in the background.
Really?
Yeah. They said, well, we don't reveal that. But I've since received a communication from a gentleman who's above a one-star general. That's all I can say, who says he knows fully well about the Defense Condition 3 declaration because his office was affected by that DEFCON 3 on the 13th of March, 1997. He's a very responsible guy, and I'm inclined to believe every word he says. So I think we're pretty, I am pretty convinced that a DEFCON 3 was declared that night.
Wow. Up on the message board, we had a number of people ask this same question. They wanted to know your opinion of advanced night vision for sighting UFOs.
I was just talking to a young woman who does night vision tours down in Sedona, Arizona. And I don't know what people are seeing with night vision binoculars or night vision devices, I should call them. I've seen some rather interesting footage that's captured with video. The one thing I would warn people about is the Chinese have put up a triplet of satellites, and a lot of people are watching them thinking that they're UFOs. They are not. Mr. Ted Molsan out of Canada, who tracks satellites, has alerted me to those. We, the U.S. Navy, once had our own. I was once fooled by them back in August of 1996 until I realized what they were. I started investigating what they could be. But you have to be very careful about just lights in the sky, even if they're seen with night vision devices. What I recommend people do is get the kind of night vision device that allows them to slave it to a video camera. So you can get a an indelible record of what is seen. Just talking about what you saw is not nearly as good, obviously, as having a photographic record of what you observed.
Right. I agree with that. Another message up there is, what time of the year is your busiest time for reports?
Usually July, and I think it's because of the 4th of July, and before any of the skeptics jump on my statement, I would encourage any listeners who are interested in this phenomenon to look at the data for the 4th of July for last year, the year before that, going back 5 or 10 years. We had a very dramatic incident over Lake Union in Seattle last July 4th. In fact, I had several of the witnesses on the Jeff Rentz radio program to describe what they saw. And, of course, it's the easiest thing in the world to say, oh, fireworks, who would doubt what they were? But they were not fireworks, and you can see the photograph that I posted to our website. I tried to get the Seattle newspapers to cover the incident. Many, many people saw the objects, and the newspapers refused to cover it. It was really a tragedy, because if they had covered it and encouraged other witnesses to come forward, we could have done a really major investigation of what was seen there. But newspapers have become pathetic, effete, milquetoast lapdogs. That's all they are today.
Okay.
And they no longer want to carry meaningful news. They want to carry factoids that are trendy and will make sure that their newspaper sells. But I question whether the American people do much reading anymore. When I was a boy, my family used to go to the county library in St. Louis once a week. We'd check out books and read them and put them back in. Now people are relying on their handheld devices, electronic devices, and usually when people call to tell me about something that they have seen in the media, it is a video done by Hollywood as opposed to a printed book or something along those lines. There's really been quite a dramatic change in how people consume their news.
Yes.
And I'm not sure it's for the good, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Question also up on the message board. How many international calls do you get, international calls?
Oh, we got international calls almost every day from around the world. I've gotten them from Thailand, from South Africa, from South America, all over Europe, from the UK pretty frequently. And people can see the reports from other nations on our website. They can sort all of the reports by state and by province and by country, and they can just look at the reports. If they have a particular interest in one country, they can see all of the reports from that country.
Right. Now I want to talk something that comes to mind to me. You mentioned the clusters of lights and things, you know, the orbs or whatever it is that people are seeing. And we had a guest on, I think about 2 months ago, that said he wrote a book on orange orbs. I think that's what it was about. But it's part of MUFON is actually doing some separate investigation that I guess he's involved in on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to talk about what other different types of crafts that get reported. I hear a lot about the triangles, and that intrigues me. You know, the triangle ones, the discs are not seen. That's what I saw, actually, but are not seen quite as often, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. In fact, if you haven't already had David Marler on as a guest,
Yeah.
Oh, you have.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's a great researcher, a great writer. As I speak, I'm holding, I just dropped his book, Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation. And he is to be commended for having made the observation that really the use of the term flying saucer is almost a misnomer, because when he invited me to look at my data to see how many of the reports in our database were triangles versus disks or lights or other things like that, two-thirds of the cases were triangular shaped. They were wedge shapes or triangles or things smacking of some kind of triangular formation. And it appears that what we should have done back on the 24th of June, 1947, when Ken Arnold made his fateful flight over the Cascade Mountains, we should have coined the term unidentified flying triangles instead of unidentified flying objects, because most of them are triangles. Ironically, what Ken Arnold saw back in June of 1947 really were not disks at all. They were sort of a scimitar-shaped object, almost a triangle. So we've come up with UFO by accident, I'm afraid, or flying saucer by accident, certainly.
I was kind of surprised to hear that how early some of the triangles have been seen. There are some sightings all the way back to the late 1800s, or something was reported back then.
I'm not surprised. They appear to be the most frequently observed type of craft or type of object that is seen and reported as a UFO. And your commenting on that takes me back to the Phoenix Lights event for a moment. The night of the event, as I mentioned earlier, at least one of the objects was intercepted by two F-15Cs, C-model jet fighters. They were armed to the teeth. They also had, according to the one witness, an airman who participated in the intercept. They had mounted under their starboard wing what's known as a Lantern 2 pod. It's a pod for night imaging and navigation. Very sensitive, very sophisticated. They have a magnifying device in the nose of the pod that allows the pilot to reach out and magnify a target so he can see it visually and get positive identification. This is what makes us convinced that those two aircraft had been flying with Air Force One and Air Force One earlier that day. But the object that the lead pilot intercepted over Camelback Mountain, which is about 3 or 4 miles north of Sky Harbor Airport, was, we've done the trigonometry, it was not less than 8,000 feet above ground level, and it subtended an arc when viewed from the ground of 135 degrees. Anybody who's familiar with trigonometry will recognize what I'm talking about and can easily do the calculation. That craft that was intercepted by that pilot was not less than 7.4 statute miles in width. 7.4 statute miles from wingtip to wingtip.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's why the government probably panicked. They thought the landing had probably started, and that's what induced the, I presume it was the U.S. Air Force, to declare a Defense Condition 3.
Wow. I never heard that part of it. Now, from what I understand, this is just bits and pieces that I heard, but that particular pilot was absolutely scared to death.
Yeah, in fact, he was pretty upset. He didn't know what he had intercepted. He reported to his ground crew that as he sat in the cockpit of his F-15 and he was streaking to the south towards this object, the left-hand wingtip of the object was visible at his 9 o'clock position, that is, out the left-hand side of his canopy. The right-hand wingtip of the craft that he was intercepting was at his 3 o'clock position. So the object that he is flying towards, no doubt it's closing velocity at many hundreds of knots, filled 180 degrees of his windscreen and canopy. And I presume that was pretty upsetting to a seasoned fighter pilot to realize how big the object was. And it takes me to the incident just over a year ago, March of last year, when the Malaysian 777 disappeared over in the vicinity of Indonesia and the Pacific Ocean, many people have asked me, well, how could you hide a 777 in a UFO? Well, if the UFOs are as big as the ones that were over Phoenix on the 13th of March, 1997, you could hide a 777 in a corner of the ashtray of one of those craft, and you'd have a hard time finding it again.
Now,
so we're dealing with very sophisticated and, in some cases, very large craft.
Yeah, that's, to me, I think, you know, we talked earlier and I mentioned, I thought incident at Exeter was one of the, you know, in the top 20 or 30. I think I consider Phoenix Lights, this is just, again, my own opinion, I would say within the top five of UFO sightings of all time.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
In fact, I never did finish my discussion of the Phoenix Lights. You asked me for, I think, the two leading cases, and I cited the Phoenix Lights. The other one that I'm very interested in is the Travis Walton case of November 5th, 1975. I feel I know Travis quite well. I trust him implicitly. And it's important to keep in mind that he was gunned down by a saucer before six witnesses. And he was gone, and for the subsequent five days, that's pretty dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
And another one I would cite along similar lines is the very strange and tragic death of Mr. Todd Sees back in August of 2002. It was Sunday, August 4th, 2002. He was seen being taken up into a saucer in Northumberland County, Pennsylvania, and it took the search party about another 39 hours to find his grossly mutilated remains. I've talked about it until I'm blue in the face, and the press is not going to pick up on it, I'm afraid.
The case in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes. It occurred on a Sunday morning. This Todd C. is age 37, I believe, very physically fit. He'd been earlier in his life, he'd been a professional wrestler or a wrestler in academia. And at 5 a.m., he left his home to go up on his family property on Mount Montour, which is a high point in southern central Pennsylvania. And 30 minutes later, four adult witnesses saw a man's body clad only in undergarments being levitated off the top of Mount Montour up a shaft of what appeared to be, to them, to the witnesses, a shaft of light, like a shaft of light out of a flashlight in a fog bank. And they had a search party was assembled that day. They didn't find him that Sunday, but about 7:15 that night, the next night on Monday, the 5th of August, Mr. C's son found human remains hanging above ground level in thick underbrush. And it's been reported to me that the remains were so grossly mutilated that not even the son could positively identify them as being the remains of his late father. Very tragic case.
Wow. Now, for the skeptic out there, you know, we always have to think of every single case, and we always hear the echoes of a skeptic and what they would say happened. What were they saying?
I'm not sure I've talked to any skeptics except a few family members. I talked to a nurse who saw the remains, and she reported to me she saw the remains in the local hospital before they were taken to the county morgue, where an autopsy was performed. But the county coroner of Northumberland County, when I talked to him briefly, said, under no certain terms would I ever have access to the autopsy report. I asked him if photographs of the decedent's remains had been taken. He said, yes, but you will never see them, Mr. Davenport. That's a pretty tall statement. Those are public records. It's not within the authority of a coroner to say you cannot see public records. So it's interesting case. And Richard Dolan has been at the site to talk to people about what happened during that incident. Very tragic case. And the one interesting thing is that this nurse described, and you can read her report on our website, again, for the, I believe it's the 4th of August, 2002, if that's a Sunday. She reported that the remains had a very peculiar metallic-looking object that was clamped to the body. And I don't know any more details than that. My impression is it was clamped to the upper arm, but I'm hard put to prove that statement is correct. So if a man was killed by a UFO while aboard a saucer, that's a pretty dramatic case by my measure.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think I've heard how we had someone on the show at one point that was talking about some possible, you know, human mutilations along with, you know, the cattle mutilations, you know, similarities in how they're mutilated. But this sounds really dramatic, and I don't really want to know if I want to get into the details of that for the listener, but of what you know, but it does not sound pretty. Bouncing around just a little bit because of the questions on the message board, someone has asked repeatedly if you think that the HARP can be the high frequency, whatever it is, radar could be used as passive radar.
No, I don't. I don't know exactly what HARP is, but my impression is it's just a radio transmitter. Although I will qualify my statement just a little bit. I commend the person who submitted the question for thinking along the lines of passive radar. It could easily be that the HARP facility is a transmitter to generate a transmitted signal that is used as part of a passive radar system. Obviously, the person who's posed the question knows what passive radar means, and I commend the person for a nice question. But I personally have no knowledge of the HARP facility and what signal it broadcasts, what the timing is, what the frequency is, what the power of it is, what the antenna field may look like, and therefore the gain may be. I just don't have the technical facts on it, so I'm really unable to comment in a very intelligent fashion, I'm afraid.
We had a show a while back. You were talking, since we're on this subject, of getting some type of evidence that, you know, this is happening. We had Doug Trumbull on along with Mark D'Antonio. I consider Mark a friend, by the way, and for those of you listeners out there that are not aware, Mark has had some real serious health issues and with his heart, and we're hoping he pulls through. He's not an old guy. He's, you know, a real nice man. They are working on a some type of project where they would have little base units here and there that would communicate with all different types of instruments. Have you ever heard about anything about the UFOTOG project?
Yes, I have. I've read about a lot of means of detecting UFOs. People use magnets, just all sorts of things. People propose that we link cell phones and so on and so forth. The problem with all of that is, for example, magnetic field falls off at the square of the distance. So detecting things with by measuring their magnetic field strength is probably not going to be very effective. People have tried to do that for decades. It hasn't worked very, very well. I really think, and what we need, rather than a bunch of teenagers with cell phones, what we need is the equivalent of ground saucer watch. I'm surprised that MUFON hasn't done this. I've calculated how many people you would need to have at high points across the United States to be able to monitor the entire geographical area of the lower 48. And it's only between 1,000 and 2,000 people.
Really?
If they're at, if they're at high points with binoculars and so on. It's just no different from a forest fire spotter system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we should be doing. The advantage of that is you suddenly have trained observers, people who know, who can distinguish an aircraft from a meteor, from an overflight of the International Space Station, from an iridium flare, and so on and so forth. And that is what we need, and MUFON has the ability to do it. I've toyed with the idea, but I don't have funding, and it's going to require a bit of funding, so everybody has binoculars, cameras, video camcorders, and so on. And we're talking about probably $1 million to outfit a couple thousand people. And we could have 100% coverage of the United States with just the personnel that MUFON has. I think they have about 10,000 members now. We could have 24-hour daylight and nighttime coverage just with the personnel they have as members.
Wow. A question that just popped up a little while ago on the message board is, what do you think these UFOs are? That is a question we all are trying to get the answer to.
Well, based on the information available to me and based on my personal experience, I was born in Missouri 67 years ago, so the show-me principle is very important to me. I don't believe anything unless I have some pretty good evidence to support my belief. But it looks to me as though we are dealing with spacecraft that do not originate from this planet. They appear to be under intelligent control, and therefore I conclude they're being controlled by alien life forms, probably very intelligent, very capable alien life forms. And why they're not showing themselves overtly, although that appears to be changing to a degree, but why they're not landing on every golf course in America and saying, teach us the game of golf, is unclear to me. And it worries me a little bit that both the aliens and our government do not want the American people thinking about this phenomenon. That is what I mentioned earlier, the possibility of collusion between an alien life force, an alien civilization, and a government. In this case, I'm alluding to the U.S. government. When I look at what the government is doing to us instead of for us, I get very concerned. It's almost as if their actions are geared to some future event that they know is going to take place. And the debt that we've accumulated is a case in point. You know, if typical game theory tells you that if a meteor is going to strike the planet Earth and destroy it tomorrow afternoon, the most logical thing for a person to do is borrow as much money as you possibly can and have the time of your life. Conversely, from the standpoint of the lender, the lender's most rational path is to lend as much as he can, because if there's going to be no tomorrow, there's no point in having money in your bank account. So it's almost as if these people in our government are acting predicated on some kind of future event that they know about, but you and I do not. That worries me.
What do you think about the Allagash case?
Very interesting case.
I mean, I agree. And I just want to mention something about this. It ties in. Basically, I got to meet Jim Wiener and Charles Foltz, but I'd never met. There's two other people involved, of course. But yeah. I listened to an interview that Alejandro Rojas did with Jack Wiener, and it was really, really a good interview. I suggest anyone look it up on Open Minds as a past podcast. But in it, you know, toward the end, he basically says that he says, well, I've never, you know, said this before, but, you know, I basically was given the message that it will be revealed and I will be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to me, as far out as that sounds, I still think that is one of the solid cases. And I'm right. I believe those guys. You know, I mean, that was just. I sat across and talked to them personally, and it's just it's like Travis Walton. I get that, and I think, you know, if that's true, that's really interesting because, you know, he's a man in his early 60s. So, you know, you never know. We may see something in our lifetime. It's possible.
Yeah. My understanding is one of the Allagash, isn't it referred to as the Allagash Five?
I believe it's four, but
might be
I
four.
Could be wrong. Could be wrong.
One of them, I think, is going to be in Newport, Rhode Island on the 12th and 13th of July for a UFO gathering. I was invited to it and unfortunately was not able to attend, but I believe I recall that one of the Allagash, I'm going to call them abductees, one of the Allagash abductees is going to be at that gathering at Newport, Rhode Island here in a couple weeks or so.
I see. Uh-huh. Okay. There's a lot of people on the message board just to let you know that really like what you're doing. And someone just posted on there, when you retire, it's going to be a huge loss. I thought you'd like to hear that.
Well, thank you. My gratitude to you and for having had me on and to all your loyal listeners and people who follow this phenomenon. From my vantage point, it appears to be a very real phenomenon, and if it's real, it's important to all of us and to all living things on this planet, I feel.
Yes.
So I appreciate the kind words, and if people are not able to get their messages into the message board today, they can just send me an email. I'd be happy to respond to their queries and to the time permitting. Right now, I'm in severe overload. People may wonder how I manage to do it. Well, typically I work or am on call two shifts a day, 7 days a week. That's the only way I can handle the volume of email and reports and media requests and interviews. It's a lot of work, but it's, in my opinion, very important work. I wouldn't want the government to be the exclusive source of information about the UFO phenomenon. They're lying through their teeth, and I don't trust them anymore.
Have you, someone had asked me one time, this is someone outside of the UFO field, when I brought up kind of what you just said or something similar, they said, just give me one fact that will prove that the government's been lying to us about UFOs.
If you
were posed that question, what would you say to that person?
I would encourage that person to get his or her own information by talking to senior officers, people who've been in positions of considerable responsibility in the military. Talk to astronauts. Edgar Mitchell is a case in point. Gordon Cooper, another case in point. I once wrote Alan Shepard. He and I grew up in the same town, East Derry, New Hampshire.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, he was raised in East Derry. He went to Pinkerton Academy, the same high school. That was the third high school I attended and graduated from. But he and I were graduates of the same high school and residents of the same town. He didn't respond, unfortunately. I sent him a bunch of material on what I was doing and pointed out that we were both from East Derry and graduates of the same high school, but that was close to the end of his life, so he may have had other considerations.
Oh, absolutely. So, Peter, we're right near the end right here. Again, if you want to give out your website, and if you'd like to, for the people on the message board, if you want to give out your email address or...
You bet.
Go ahead.
If anybody is listening to us who's had a UFO sighting and they haven't reported it, they can do so using the online report form, a blank online fill-in-the-box type report form at ufocenter.com. My email address, if they have personal messages for me, email address is director@ufocenter.com. And our hotline is area code 206-722-3000. So website is ufocenter.com. Email is director@ufocenter.com. And the hotline is 206-722-3000. Been in continuous operation for almost 41 years now.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much, Peter. That's the end of the show.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been delightful, and it seems like about a 15-minute show, but it
sure went by fast. I could talk to you for a lot longer than that. Well, I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show tonight, Alejandro Rojas. I want to thank him for joining us for the news. Again, that's going to be live from here on out. I want to thank Peggy Shunning for managing the Facebook page. Like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Next week, we have Israel Curiel from North Carolina. He's a MUFON spokesperson. There he'll be on. And I think that's about it for us tonight. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week. If you're listening now, you are a supporter of the show, and I want to thank you for that. And you can listen live every week on the Dark Matter Digital Network.